I'm Ben Wolfson. I'm an alcoholic. I'm English by birth. I'm Irish by disease. Scotch by absorption. And American by adoption. I hope that some of you may have witnessed this demonstration of relative faith that we've had tonight. I have been here before, I have spoken at this meeting before, and I know the people who were responsible for asking me, Delphina and Dean here, and I think it is tremendous demonstration of faith that they should ask me back. I mean, that is something tremendous. But then I realized they had reservations when they took the collection before they allowed me to speak. Particularly when they have financial problems, you know. They couldn't quite risk it. By the way, the best seat in the house is vacant here. I shan't be needing it, so if somebody wants to sit in the intensive care section right down here, if you can risk walking all the way down here. This talk is not going to be in any sequence whatsoever, because I don't get the messages in any particular sequence, so those of you who plan to take notes, tough shit. I don't speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't come here to agree with you. I get a chance to disagree. Isn't that fun? I don't even have to agree with your sponsor. I need to tell you that I've been sober a little over a week and a month and 20 years. And December the 12th, 1970 is my sober date. And as you can gather, I just had a birthday, and I thought it was a real important birthday because I was hoping that some people would start to take me seriously. You know, after all, 20 years sobriety is a long time for a drunk of my type. And I thought they might, you know, get to take me seriously, but it hasn't happened yet. I remember Clancy telling me when he was 19 years sober it was going to happen when he was 20 years sober, and we're just putting it off. And I think that's fun, you know, that Saturday night we can come out and have a whole lot of fun for a change. I used to go out to try and have a whole lot of fun, and it seldom was fun. I mean, I'm not a part of the group in Alcoholics Anonymous that say, you know, my best day drinking was worse than my worst day sober. I mean, shit. God. I mean, just listen to my sober story and you'll get some of that. I said I was an alcoholic, and Lara said she was an alcoholic, and we haven't had to give you a definition of alcoholism, and I'm not going to give you a definition of alcoholism because we don't deal in definitions in Alcoholics Anonymous. We deal in descriptions. And I'm going to give you a description of an alcoholic. Drunk and sober, right or wrong. You see, because if I gave you definitions, you could argue with them. But when I give you a description, you can't argue with it. That's a hell of a deal, you know. I can come up here, talk about my favorite subject for an hour, and sit down, and you can have opinions about me, but you can't argue with me. And that's a hell of a deal. I drank, and then I got sober, and then I got wonderful, and then I got real. And then I lied about it. That's probably somewhere about where I am at the moment. I lied and cheated and stole and gossiped and had lustful thoughts before I ever took a drink of alcohol. And in December 1970, I was sitting in a lunatic asylum in group therapy blaming the fact that I was a convicted felon on my intake of alcohol. I'd been a thief before I drank. There's something wrong with the picture. But you see, that's what most of us do. We blame booze for our reduced circumstances, and we're in real trouble. Because it's like I tell the story about if you watch people playing tennis in the park, I don't know whether any of you have done this, and you see somebody miss the ball and they look at the racket. Well, you can't get to Wimbledon if you look at the racket when you miss the ball. I mean, even John McEnroe doesn't do that. And there was I looking at the racket, you see. I'm saying, my problem is that I drink. My problem was never that I drank. My solution was always that I drank. I was a crazy teenager who had not learned to drink properly. And I was on my way to doing something outrageous. And then I found alcohol and it was all right. I didn't have to do anything crazy. But if I hadn't found alcohol to work, I'm the sort of person, I would have gone into McDonald's one day with an Uzi. I was a very disturbed young man who looked normal. And that's the confusing thing. When I looked at myself in the mirror, I did not look with particular distaste. I didn't look with much narcissism either. I just said, you know, that's me. And inside, I was crazy. I was very disturbed. I was very nervous. And yet I had tremendous ambitions. I was compelled to do things. I was a coward, too. I need to tell you that. This isn't a popular topic, but I'll talk about cowardice at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I talk about being afraid, and since I've talked about being a coward and being afraid, I haven't been afraid of very much. That's puzzling. That's real weird, isn't it? When I tell you I'm afraid and I'm a coward, and then I'm not afraid, but that's how it's been. But I was very afraid. I was nervous a lot of the time. And I did something about it. I mean, I did something to overcome my fear. I looked around and I saw the people who didn't show fear, and I became one of them. I was brought up with horses, and the people who absolutely demonstrated that they were not afraid were steeplechase jockeys. So I became one. And I wasn't really very afraid of riding those horses over fences any more than anything else. I was just afraid the whole time. And, you know, it's a weird sensation to have to do that to overcome your fear. And I got injured a whole lot. So the price of doing business out there on a racetrack. And then I was resentful of the discipline at home. There was a lot of discipline at home. There was a lot of bullshit, too. I have no idea whether our house was more dysfunctional than yours. I have one little thing that I need to tell you about dysfunctional families. I am the co-founder of two of them. All I got to say. The only thing I have to say about codependency is what it says in the big book. One sentence. We have to quit playing God, it didn't work. All it says. And it's important to me to own up to the fact that I started families that didn't work. But to not blame the family I come from. It was just as it was. They did their best. I don't know whether anybody else's did better. But it was very important in my upbringing to be right, and discipline seemed to be an important part of being right. I don't know where that worked, but my point is that I didn't like the discipline at home, so I joined the army. Now, I didn't just join the army. I went to the British equivalent of West Point, where they are experts at discipline. I mean, they taught me things that I didn't learn again until I had one of those old-fashioned gangster sponsors. I mean, they taught me that 4.5 minutes early was late, and I had a sponsor who explained to me very simply that 15 minutes early for the meeting was on time. And, you know, and he would look at his watch if I came in late. It was a good, you know, it was a good start. But there I was in the army, learning how to be somebody important. and being important was important to me. It always has been important to be important. And I got to sort of grow up. I was 21, I had scars on my shoulder, chainmail, all this stuff, you know, carried a sword. And I was an officer in the cavalry, and I had a tremendous idea of my own importance. Nobody else gave a shit. And incidentally, when you are worried about what the Gallup poll is going to think about you, I want to tell you what the figures are. The figures always are that 10 people will approve, 10 people will disapprove, or 100 people will approve and 100 people disapprove. That's probably likely tonight. At the end of this meeting, 100 people will approve and 100 people will disapprove. And 5.2 billion won't give a shit. Now, that's always the statistic. You see? And I get it introspective when I realize that 5.2 billion people don't give a shit about anything I ever do. So it's about time I care. The caring mechanism did not work with my drinking. I ceased to care about things. I ceased to care about people. I ceased to care about people's opinion. And then it got unpleasant. Like I ceased to care about my own health, about my cleanliness, about my sanitary habits. I took my last drink on the fourth floor of a maximum security penitentiary, and it's my only claim to being a high-bottom drunk. But I was just reminded that there was a psychiatrist who was he was interviewing me, which is always fun, and he asked me these questions, because he was trying to prove whether I was an alcoholic or not. I mean, why didn't he just give me a drink? I don't know, but he asked me all these questions. And one of them was, did you wet the bed? And I just looked him straight in the eye and said, no. I mean, it seemed to be the thing to do. And yet I wanted him to believe I was an alcoholic so he could tell the judge so I could get off. But you asked me a question like that, and I just said no. And I suppose it was the truth if I was looking at it like that. But I used to wet the bed, you see. And I was thinking about this one day. I was talking at a meeting rather like this, and I suddenly remembered something I'd forgotten for years. I had taken my best friend home to become our roommate because we were short of money. And whatever his name was, he didn't have any money, but he was going to get some money. You know how this goes? So we put him in the spare room, and I went to bed, and I woke up, I didn't really wake up. I sort of came to, and instead of peeing on her shoes in the closet, which was sort of fairly normal, I went into the spare room, and I came to peeing on this guy's bed. I mean, it gets better. And I browned out again. I mean, it was too much for me. But the next day she said to me how this guy had wet the bed. And she threw his ass in the street and I let her. But when the psychiatrist said to me, did you ever wet the bed? I said no. But you know I had problems with honesty when I got here. And I don't think this is an honest program, contrary to what you hear at the meeting. It's a program that demands rigorous honesty. We have to grasp and develop a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. We don't have to be honest. And that may upset some people. But if you're new, and you've come here tonight with high standards, welcome to the real world. I love it when people say, and I am never going to lie again, I am going to live a life of total honesty. And I say, you know, we'll still be here when you get real. I saw a bumper sticker that changed my life about 5 years ago, and it said, "When all else fails, lower your standards." Oh, God. You see, my problem was I had high standards for you and low standards of my performance. And that'll get you into a heap of trouble. Look at Jimmy Swaggart, I mean. You know? It really doesn't matter much what we do as long as our feet and our mouth are in the same place. You know, I mean, if you're on the top of the hill, make sure your feet are there and your mouth. And if you're down there in the red light district, make sure your mouth's down there too. Because there's nothing worse than pretending we're somebody else. I believe that this is one of the reasons why we have so many people leave us. People resign from Alcoholics Anonymous for two reasons, as I see it. And they are that they're not willing to work with other alcoholics, and that they're not willing to tell us who they are. And I think those are two very intertwined things. I see lots of people leaving, and I don't know. I don't know where it is. It's somewhere after a year, and it goes on. People keep on resigning. I was at a meeting up in Auburn, California, about 2 years ago, and I was speaking at a meeting I'd spoken at 13 years before. And they had all the birthdays on the wall, you know, people's sobriety times. And there was one person who had 13 years on this enormous board. And the room was full this last time I was there. And it had been there 13 years before the room had been full. And I don't know where everybody went. I mean, I don't think everybody drinks again. But they don't seem to get this good life. I was talking to a doctor one day, and that's always fun. And he was explaining how he could heal alcoholics without them actually having to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, "You don't understand." And it was very obvious he didn't understand as the conversation developed. And I explained that the benefit of Alcoholics Anonymous was belonging to Alcoholics Anonymous. This was not somewhere that we traveled through on our way to somewhere else. Being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is the benefit of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I have no more fun anywhere that I ever go than being in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, that's weird. But it changed because it was not always so. And if any of you are new and don't want to be here, I mean, there will be some of you who don't want to be here tonight. If you're here sober, wishing you were in a bar drunk, just think how much better that is than all of those who are out there in the bar drunk tonight, wishing they were in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous sober. Because you can change it, I mean you can leave right now, but if you did, it would be very embarrassing to you. I mean, if you got up right now and left, we'd all know where you're going. But I mean, you can slide out at the end of the meeting and change it. That guy out there who maybe has chips in his pocket or has traded his chips for a drink, you think about it. I was on my way to the office one morning about 10 years ago, and there was a bar at the corner of the street where I had my office, and it was about 6:05 in the morning as I drove round the corner with my then wife, and there was one car parked outside the bar, and she said, "God, what a thought to be in a bar at 6:05 in the morning." And I said, "Yes, and you may not have noticed it had an Easy Does It sticker on it." You know, I mean, that's sad when you've got an Easy Does It sticker on a car outside a bar at 6:05 in the morning. But that's the place to go from here. That's the alternative. And it sometimes isn't as clear as that to me when I'm complaining about the spirituality of my home group. And I was doing this one day, and there was an old-timer who used to get in my face a lot. And I got sober right at the end of that gangster era of sponsors. Most of them have died, unfortunately. some wonderful people, and a guy called Chester Gifford. He got sober in 1946, and he used to get my faith a whole lot. And I remember I was talking about my home group in that faint praise mode, like I'm complaining, but I was doing it without actually sniveling. But he picked up on it right away, and he said to me, "You're going to the meetings to get your sobriety, aren't you?" And I fell for it, and I said, "Yes, one day at a time, that's what I go to the meetings for." And he said, "You selfish son of a bitch." And I went, "Oh." Wrong answer, you know. Wrong answer. And he then told me that if I would take my sobriety to the meeting and give it away, my life would absolutely change. And he absolutely promised me that, and he's been absolutely right. And I haven't gone to the meeting to get my sobriety in the last 16 years. I take my sobriety to give it away. And there was another man I knew whose story's in the big book, the career officer in the book, if you want to check it out. And those of you who are afraid to talk about drugs at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, please read Sackville's story in the big book. He talks about three particular drugs in one paragraph, and he was the squarest man I ever knew. He was an old British Army officer, and he talks about how it really was, and he says that he has to give this thing away in his own best interest, and goes on with a phrase which has saved my life on two or three occasions, and he says that success and failure are never final, and neither count for very much in the final assessment of a man who's done his best. And this man I met when I was about a year sober, and I didn't meet him the first time, he was a speaker, and I was way at the back, I tell you, way at the back, and I listened to this old fart, and he talked about faith, hope, and love. And I thought, you know, the last time you knew about love is so long ago. I mean, you could tell. You could just tell. And so I switched him off. You know, there was really nothing to hear apart from this story about faith, hope, and love. And I heard him again a couple of years later, and he was still talking the same crap about faith, hope, and love. But this time I'd been doing some of that love. And I said, "Right on." And I could hear what he said. I could hear what he was talking about working with other alcoholics. And we've heard tonight about we'll love you until you love yourself. And I want to add that the only way you'll get to love yourself is by loving somebody else who's unlovely. Because you're unlovely, and you'll practice on somebody else. And that's how it works. And love is an action, it's not a feeling. Gratitude is an action, not a feeling. And when I came to work with other people who I could not stand, my attitude to me changed. And I don't know, there's no logic in this. No more logic than telling you I'm a coward has allowed me not to be afraid very much. But it's changed my life. I'd better tell you about drinking, really, because I always get into this feeling that I'm going to sound like the lecturer from London, and heaven forbid, you know. I threw up a lot in the mornings. We'll start with the mornings, you know. I know how to go to the bathroom and not get into trouble. You take a bottle with you, right? Because throwing up water doesn't work well with a system of my type. You have to get something else to... So I'd take the bottle with me and have a good slug, and I'd keep the third one down most of the time. I drank my way out of families. I drank my way out of jobs. Drank my way out of houses. All that good stuff. And I just progressed like a regular alcoholic downhill. I think today as I drove up, my drinking was rather like the shortcut to a good martini. Started off with everything, you know, stirrer, the right shaped glass, lemon peel, an olive, the right ratio of gin to vermouth, which is 25 to 1, you know that. If anybody's getting thirsty, bear with me. And then gradually, the standard of this thing eroded. The olive went. And then the lemon peel went. And then the vermouth went. And then the glass went. And that's really the story of my drinking. You know, then the glass went. I used to consort with gangsters at one time. We would drink in a bar in Earl's Court Road in London, which is nicknamed Kangaroo Valley. There are a lot of Australians there. And we would go, when the pub closed, we would buy a case of Foster's Lager each and a couple of flat bottles to put in our jacket pockets. And the case of Foster's was to sit on, because we'd probably go to an abandoned apartment somewhere and spend the afternoon drinking, and, you know, you could sit on the case of Foster's until you drank too many of the cans and it collapsed. But it had practical attitudes, you know. I mean, I was drinking amongst that crowd and thinking that this was truly freedom. I'd been, at the age of 23, 24, I'd been in the army still, and I was on the short list to be the ADC, to the Chief General of the British Army. And 14 years later, I was drinking with gangsters on Skid Row. I wasn't drinking with gangsters. I was a gangster drinking on Skid Row, because I was one of them. That was how it was. I stole for a living the last 4 months I drank on the outside. I'd had a job. I had lots of jobs. Good job, bad job. One day let me tell you how it was. I had this... We always have to back up a little, don't we? You can tell this isn't a canned pitch. It's always different, I tell you. Though I have all the requirements for being a circuit speaker. I drove 285 miles today to talk, and some nights I won't even cross the road to listen. That's the requirement of a circuit speaker. So let me back up. I lived on one side of the town with her, and on the other side of the town with her. One was my wife, and the other was a girlfriend, and I used to drive backwards and forwards, and there were bars in between, and it was the ideal life for an alcoholic. I remember once I left here to go there with a really good excuse to be away for 3 or 4 days. And I got drinking on the way across town, and I came out of a parking lot and turned the wrong way, and I was back where I started at the beginning. I mean, weird stuff. You know, can't use that excuse again. Well, the one I wasn't married to came to me one day and said, the police are looking for us. And I said, why? And she said, I don't know, but they're looking for us. And this was bad news. Because at that period of my life, my definition of trouble was being found out. And, you know, I didn't want to be found out for whatever it was. So I said, well, we'd better leave town. Which made absolute sense to me. So we left town. But I've always been very prudent about my banking. I mean, I don't want any of you to feel guilty if you haven't been as prudent as me. I always had lots of checkbooks. So I went round town cashing checks the following morning, and we decided to run off to the Welsh Mountains, which is where her father owned a hotel. And it seemed sort of glamorous. I don't know whether any of you ever saw the movie 39 Steps, but it had that sort of feeling about getting away from the police in central England, and getting to the Welsh Mountains would be wonderful. Well, we got the money, and we left town, and we stopped at a bar on the way out of town. It was on the left-hand side of the road, which is important. because crossing oncoming traffic when you're about to have your first drink of the day is something that is not advisable. You know, I've got other advice for people who drink again. That was one. I mean, that's just a gem. But make sure you're driving on the other side of the road when you do that, because here we drive on the right-hand side of the road. But the advice for people who drink again is always drink the cheap stuff. And this is very, very important. Very serious, too. Because if you drink the cheap stuff, you won't resent it as much when you throw it up. And you'll be able to drink more and get back here quicker. Well, we went into this bar and I read the racing page of the paper and I said, we don't have enough money, we better go for the races. So we turned around and we went to Newmarket for the races, and it was one of those good days drinking, you know? I mean, couldn't count the money if we left the racetrack. I'd been in the bar when the horse won the third leg of this Triella that I'd backed, and I just poked my head out the window. I was watching him on television. I wasn't a fool. I mean, I was drinking and watching him on television. So I just poked my head out so I could actually see the horse go past the post in front. And that was a good day at the races. And instead of going to Wales, we went to London, and she booked a room at one of the better hotels in London, and I said, you better use an assumed name just in case. And I didn't know what that meant until 4 or 5 days later, when the money had run out and we're going out through the back door, which came into an alley, not onto Piccadilly and all the grandeur at the front. And it's about 5 o'clock in the morning, and we're coming out into this alley, and we get in the car and split, having left the suitcase behind, you know. And that was to be a way of life for 4 or 5 months. We did a lot of shopping during that time. We bought a lot of things for people like you who wanted things, and we would buy them for half price for you. And that was a good business. As long as we had enough checkbooks, and I mean, that's all we needed to do. There were a few close calls. We got chased one day. We bought shoes a lot. I don't know why, but we bought shoes and we sold them to the butcher. It made absolute sense to me at the time. I suppose it would now, because the butcher paid us for the shoes. But we had this little van full of shoes, and I didn't realize at the time, but she used to say, my husband's blind, and I have to buy his shoes for him. And she came out with these pairs of shoes and got into this van, and I drove away, and he chased us up the hill on foot and nearly caught us. I mean, it was a very old van. I'd had this company car when we decided to split, and the last day I was working for this company, I got the registration papers for the car out of the company safe. I'd made some excuse. I didn't know why at the time, but not too long after that I knew why, because I had to sell it. That's why. Turn it into some money in this little van. It was one afternoon, and It's important to explain that it wasn't very glamorous, because it's easy to talk about this, I can get off on it very easily. And all this glamour about stealing, well, it wasn't very glamorous. I mean, I'm a coward, but I'm a manager, so I sat in the bar and told her what to do. She loved to shop, and she'd wear different wigs and different get-ups, so she wasn't recognized, and I was in the bar this day, and she came rushing in, and she said, they've taken my ID, I think they know who I am, and I think they've called the police. I said, you better have a drink. We then had another drink, collected our shopping, went outside, and we stood at a bus stop and waited for one of those double-decker red buses to come along. And, you know, we got on the top deck of the bus and made our getaway. You know, rather like Richard Burton in that Stolen Jaguar, you probably saw the movie. It was something like that that I was talking about as I was walking around the exercise yard. But the truth is that I made the getaway on the top of a red double-decker bus. And eat your heart out, Richard Burton, we got away. We made it, but not for long. We got caught one night, and I thought it was the end of the world, you know. We were arrested, and all that humiliating stuff. And she got bail, and they wouldn't give me bail. I'd run out on a couple of social drunken driving charges. I'd missed the bail, and they didn't want to let me out anymore. And there was nobody to stand the bail for me anyway. And so there was I, and I was in this old castle-type prison. I mean, it's a bad place, you know. I mean, it's like Folsom. I've been in Folsom. That's pretty scary. This was not too good either. And I stayed there for several months, and I drank a little bit in there, and then I got to be on, not on the fourth floor anymore. You couldn't drink when you came down from the fourth floor, and so that was bad. Got to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous in the joint. Got to take my last drink there. Got to be interviewed by that psychiatrist. Important things I read in the big book about the man who'd been drinking and quit for 25 years. It's on page 32, and that impressed the hell out of me, because when he sold his business and he had plenty of money and he'd retired, he was able to start drinking again, he thought, and within a very short time he was trying to stop and he couldn't. And within, I don't know whether it's 3 or 4 years, he was dead. And I said, "Ben, you must never ever drink again." And one of the Saturdays during this period, I was watching television, and as I say, I was brought up in horse racing, and there was we were watching racing, and the winner of the big race that afternoon was trained by a very dear friend of mine, and I'm sitting there and I'm watching Tim being congratulated and being interviewed and all this stuff on BBC television, and I wondered what was wrong, you know, because I'm sitting on this hard back chair in the prison chapel, and my friend's just, you know, on a winning streak. And for the first time in my life, I said, "This may not be bad luck. This may not be bad luck. This could be something wrong with you, Ben." And it was just the crack in the door that was opening to allow me to be wrong, to allow me to know there was something wrong with me. And I'd never told Tim about this, and I wrote to him for my 20th AA birthday, and I wrote and told him about it. And he's been important in my story. The first time that I got some money together to start making some financial amends was when he trained his first Grand National winner, and I had some spare money, and I started to send some checks to people. And you know, you'll hear people around who'll say, "Well, I can't find those people, and so I'm not going to be able to make amends to them." Well, you'll never know if you can find them until you try looking for them, will you? I owed a man called Larry Major some money. He'd owned a bar. He was a retired steeplechase jockey, and he'd owned a bar, and I sent a check to him that day, and it came back that he'd gone away. He'd drunk himself out of the bar and out of his marriage and out of the county, and I started to look for Larry, because it was one of those days when he just opened the till and said, "Take what you like and leave a check." I'm the wrong guy to do that to. I left somebody else's check and took as much as I could, and as I say, the check came back, and it wasn't good enough for me to say I can't find him. And I know a lot of people in horse racing in England, and I started to tell people I was looking for Larry Major. And it was one of those detective things. People would call me and say, "Try so-and-so, and I hear you're looking for Larry, and call so-and-so." And one day somebody called up, a jockey I know called up and said, "This is Larry Major's telephone number. I gather you're looking for him." And he was the other side of the country, and he was out of racing, and he was out of a bar. And I don't know how he was found, but he was found. And I remember one evening with trepidation, I called this number, and I said, "Hi, Larry, it's Ben Wolf." And he said, "How are you doing?" And I said, "All right." I said, "About that money I owe you. I had to get it in right before he started, you know." And he said, "What money?" You know, he's an alcoholic of my type. He didn't remember whose check it was. And didn't, you know, he'd probably been in a blackout. And I sent him the money and I wrote and told him about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't know whether he's ever found us. The last letter I got from him some years ago, he was still talking about that brain damage from concussions on the racetrack, and that's why he couldn't remember things. And I'm writing back to him and talking to him about blackouts. I don't know, it's helped me to stay sober. And working with other alcoholics has been the great gift of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we have a saying in San Francisco, I don't know where it comes from, but it's, if you don't work with other alcoholics will get to work with you. And you may not think you're ready, but you'll never be more ready than you are tonight unless you drink again. The only way to get more ready to help somebody is to feel more desperate. And the only way to feel more desperate is to get drunk again. And if you're new and you don't know how to help somebody, I will tell you that you know the two most important things in Alcoholics Anonymous already. And you can help the person who's at their first meeting. The two most important things in Alcoholics Anonymous for the newcomer to discover is that the coffee's free and that the schedules are on the table. You see, if they don't know the coffee's free, they may not be able to drink it because they're afraid the next 7 days. So you can start from the very beginning with sharing your experience, because I know, and I did it. It wasn't quite like that. It was, I'd read this big book that had been handed to me, and I was walking around the exercise yard the next day, and I was on my first 12-step call. I'd never met any of you. None of you had told me I needed to know more in order to help somebody else. Thank God. Thank God I hadn't met the Vice Squad yet. And I was walking with an alcoholic. I had shared a cell with this man. And there are those coy ones amongst us who say, I can't tell anyone they're alcoholic. I refer you to the big book, chapter 3. And it says, we do not like to pronounce anyone alcoholic. Doesn't say we don't do it, just says we don't enjoy doing it. I said, Ralph, you're a goddamn drunk and an alcoholic. And if you and I go to Alcoholics Anonymous, we need never come back here. Here was a disbarred member of the Institute of Bankers and a retired cavalry officer walking around the exercise yard together, sharing our experience, strength, and hope. I got out before he did, and he became a great opportunity for me to carry on 12-step work. I remember a day I was about 4 months sober, and I hitchhiked 150 miles each way to the joint he was in to encourage him to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then got back to go to my regular Wednesday night meeting. Getting to meetings was not easy. My brain is broken, and I want to tell you that before I accuse anybody else of having a broken brain. There are those amongst you with broken brains. There are those amongst you with broken gauges, because I believe this is a disease of broken gauges. And if I can tell you a little bit about broken gauges. I can remember sweating on cold days and shivering on hot days. I think my thermometer was broken. I can remember going into a bar for two drinks and coming out 2 hours later, 2 days later, 2 weeks later, and all the time I would be saying, keep filling me up, Jack. And I just overflowed at both ends sometimes, and I'm still saying, fill me up. The capacity gauge was broken. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and I say, I think, and one of those old farts says, with what? With what? I just kept away from him. I mean, I kept away from these people for a time, and then I got to understand that they loved me more than I loved me. And I nearly didn't go to my first meeting. Well, in fact, I didn't go to the first meeting I could have done because my mind got in the way. I was looking out of the window of this lunatic asylum where I resided, and I was watching the sponsors for the AA meeting arrive, and they were a very sorry lot. I mean, very sad, I've got to tell you. They came in old automobiles, rusty old automobiles, very sick people. Some came on bicycles. Now that's a sign of a lower companion, if ever there was one. And then some pedestrians arrived. They came by bus, they disembarked at the top of the hill, and they walked down, and they laughed. I mean, this is sad, when people who have arrived by bus are laughing. And there am I, a week sober, sitting in the lunatic asylum, judging these people, and they came up wanting. I mean, they were a sad crowd. The only trouble was that I couldn't say to me, look me, you don't have enough money to put gas in a car. You don't have a driver's license to operate a car. You don't have a bicycle. You don't even have the freedom to go out of the front door to walk up to the bus stop. But I couldn't say that. So I didn't go to the meeting. My gauges are definitely broken, and there is no retrofit program, I tell you that. I've been looking for new gauges for 20 years, and there's a line in the big book which has changed my attitude, and that's where it says, lack of power was our dilemma, and I read that just as it says for a long time, and now I say lack of power is my solution. Every time I think I got power, I got problems. When I say lack of power is my solution, you know, somebody said, will you speak here? I said, if there's a vacancy in the diary, if it's empty, you got it. I mean, that's lack of power. It's really simple. I came up here, we did a four-step workshop in this room a year or so ago, and I did not like the airplane they had chosen. You know, I said, can I have a window seat? They said, they're all window seats. Something has gone wrong with this airline coming up here, and I don't like that, you know, and it jumped and bumped and kicked all the way up the coast, and for about 10 minutes I felt nervous, just nervous, you know. I put my book down and I'm studying the airplane, you know. And then I realized lack of power was my solution. I didn't have a pilot's license that day. I couldn't do anything about it. So I opened the book up and carried on reading, and it was all right. And it's amazing. When you do things like that, amazing things happen. I have come to understand the last few months that when my feet hit the carpet, the decision-making's over for the day. Now, if you knew, that's weird. If you're still working on the issues, that's very weird to think that, you know, there's nothing more to be done. Just put your feet on the carpet and it's all over. And I'm having a hell of a time. I just do what seems to be in front of me and it seems to work. So, there we are about broken gauges. I did go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're coming close to time, aren't we? My God. I want to tell you a few war stories and then we'll get out of here because... I think we've had... Are we having fun tonight? Last June, we started this group, High Sobriety, which is giving a conference on March the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. I'm going to take a one-minute spot here. There are flyers out on the raffle table. We've got some good speakers. And this group, High Sobriety, started last June, and the speaker for the first meeting, Rodney Clark, is the guy I sponsor, and he'd come up from Los Angeles to speak, and we went to the Braves game that afternoon, that evening at Candlestick Park, and I took him after the game to book in at his motel, and we booked him in, and then I wanted to show him where the 7 o'clock in the morning meeting was so that I didn't have to drive into town to take him to the meeting. He could walk, you know. and just sort of selfish, lazy part of me. So we drove to this meeting, and I said, there it is, and he said, aren't we going to a meeting there? I said, there's an 11 o'clock meeting, and I really don't want to go, I want to go home, and anyway, there's nowhere to park. And he said, there's a place right there. So we parked. And I was doing something I didn't want to do, because I ought to. And I went into a meeting at the back, Rodney and I went into this meeting, and there was one guy from San Diego who had a year's sobriety, and there was about 3 hours and 27 minutes between the rest of them. And I sat in this meeting because I ought to, but not because I wanted to. And I shared because I ought to, not because I wanted to. And I found myself at the end of the meeting talking to the man who was very drunk, because I ought to, not because I wanted to. And out of my mouth came, would you like to have coffee with us? And I went, oh, shit. Why did you say that? So we took him to coffee, and Rodney poured out his bottle of vodka, and we started him writing down his list of fears on the napkin. And we discovered that he'd been sober for 9 years and had never done any of the steps, and been drunk for 2 years. And we wrote down those 6 fears, you know, I'm afraid of drinking, I'm afraid of not drinking, I'm afraid of being alone, I'm afraid of being with people, I'm afraid of being broken, I'm afraid of having money. And right after he's finished writing, you say, well, if that's true, there's no human solution to the fact that you're going to be terrified for the rest of your life. You better pray the program will work for you. So we took him back to Rodney's motel room, and 4 of us knelt down and we said the third step prayer. Not because I wanted to, but because I had to. And then I drove him back to the Tenderloin, to a nasty hotel, and I didn't want to do that. I got a new silver Mercedes, and I didn't want to be driving in the Tenderloin at 2 o'clock in the morning. But I did it because I ought to, and then I drove home, and I took my lower power for a walk as soon as I got home, that lower power that Dean was talking about, a little cocker spaniel called Angus. And I took him for a walk, and it's about 2:30 in the morning, and I'm walking across the parking lot, and this car stops, and these 2 gorgeous young women get out, and I went, all right. And they both said, do you have a plunger? And I said, yes, of course. Well, it transpired they got a blocked up toilet. And I said, yes, I'll bring my plunger up and I'll help you. And unfortunately, one of them had a husband, so he was dealing with the toilet. And they said, would you like a drink? And I don't know why. I've never been shy about my sobriety, but sometimes I talk about AA and sometimes I don't. I'm about as anonymous as Sears Roebuck. But I just said, I don't drink. I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for 19 and a half years. I'll have a cup of tea, please. Husband came out of the bathroom, having washed himself and cleaned the toilet and done all that stuff, introduced himself to me, turned out to be English, bit of a coincidence. We started talking real estate, and that's what I do for a living, and as a result of this conversation, I listed their condo, and we sold that, and then I bought them a 3-unit building and closed that, I think, the week before last, and so it took about 6 months, but made a lot of money. I mean, this is not about money, this program, I know, but I just want to tell you, as a result of doing things which I didn't want to do, but because I ought to, I was in exactly the right place at the right time to make a tremendous amount of money. And now I want to tell you the rest of the story. You see, the woman who was visiting this couple from Washington, D.C., came to stay with them again at Christmas. And my friends called me up one day and they said, this isn't a real estate conversation. You see, this lady is coming from Washington to stay with us for Christmas, and we want to be able to show her where the meetings are because she got sober in July. 2 weeks after I'd said to her, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, haven't had a drink for 19 and a half years, please give me a cup of tea. You know, God is about his business. And we have a part to play. I believe we only have a part to play. When she got here, it was fun because I took her to a meeting and she did that. In Virginia, we wait till we're a year sober before we do the fourth step. And I said, lady, you said that to the wrong person. Lean into the back seat, I said, and pick up that blue book and start to read to me. And by the time she went back to Washington, she was halfway through her fourth step. I want to share something that a lot of people say we oughtn't to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of people say we shouldn't work with our families because it doesn't work. And I want to tell you that I took my baby sister to her first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the spring of 1971. Not because I thought she was an alcoholic, but because I knew she was married to one. And a little over 20 months ago, the same man who'd given me my first big book gave her her first big book. And she's been sober for a little over 20 months. Took her a long time, and I didn't think of her as an alcoholic because she didn't drink as much as me. And then one day, shortly after she got sober, I said, maybe you drank more than me. You drank for 18 years after I quit. Well, we were talking about the dog at Dean's, I got a couple of dog stories, and then it really is time to quit, isn't it? This lower power of mine, like he said, listens to fifth steps, and I've fallen asleep listening to fifth steps, and Angus will nod his head and listen and all that good stuff. And one day he knocked the telephone off when it rang, and it was a newcomer, and the newcomer is saying hello, and Angus is barking, and John Nolan had only had a day's sobriety at that time, and I think he's now had about nearly 9 years, and he was calling for help, and he was talking with my lower power, and that worked. But on a night when I went out to fetch a drunk, and I've always enjoyed fetching drunks, almost as much as I enjoy going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I always wanted to get in the AA 12-step Hall of Fame. I thought, if I could get more drunks and get more of them sober, then I would be remembered better. And I was on my way to fetch a drunk, and I drove past a meeting that was just coming out in Folsom, and two people I know very well were in the parking lot, and I stopped and said, hey, jump in, I'm going to see a drunk. And they jumped in, and we got there, and this guy was very, very drunk, extremely drunk. And he didn't hear anything we had to say. So we each gave a 10-minute pitch, and then it was time to go. You know, you can't do more than you can do. And he was seeing us out of the front door, and he's standing there and staggering. And he looked at us and said, you're good people. And I said, yeah, I know we're good people. We beat the fire brigade here. You know, something inane like that. And he said, no, but the dog didn't bite you. And I said, what dog? And the dog was licking Whitey's hand, and he wasn't savaging Whitey. This dog normally savaged everybody. They had to lock it in the garage when they had visitors, but he wasn't attacking us. I don't know. I suppose we were about our father's business, and this is really a pointless story. except that the following night, this guy, Ted, was standing on his front doorstep at 7:30 when I drove up to take him to his first AA meeting because we were good people. And I understand from one of the three of us who was there that he's been sober ever since. So it's very important when you go out on 12-step calls not to let the dog bite you. It's serious now, isn't it? We don't take nothing here. And I remember hearing a man sharing at a meeting, and I talked to him afterwards, and it turned out that he'd been taking drugs a lot in the 8 years he hadn't drunk, and he said to me, can you help me? And I said, yes, I think I can. And over the next 3 days, we did his fourth and fifth step, day and night. It didn't seem we had a whole lot of sleep, and yet he couldn't trust what we were doing, and he'd given me all his drugs, and I got rid of them, and he kept a bottle of aspirin, and the third day took this bottle of aspirin and was hospitalized. And I couldn't go and see him the first day. I just was mentally incapable of going to see him, and I saw him 2 days later, and he wasn't the same person. And that was New Year's Eve of 1975. And like I say, he hadn't had a drink for 8 years, but he'd had a whole lot of drugs. And he drank again in March of 1975, and it was a Thursday, and they found him dead in his car on Saturday, 3 days of drinking in 8 years. And I want to tell you why Tom Abraham died. Tom Abraham died because when he was 3 years sober, and a result of not taking the steps, he couldn't sleep. And because he couldn't sleep, he went to a friendly physician, and the friendly physician did the only thing he knew how to do, was write on a prescription pad. And because Tom wasn't taking the steps and he couldn't sleep, he took this stuff. And of course it didn't work, and he had to find more doctors. And Tom died 8 years later because he hadn't taken the steps and he couldn't sleep, and he went to the doctor. And when I heard that, I said, I hope Tom Abraham didn't die in vain. And I don't think he did.